a little lullaby for a queen by a composer named Béraud. And the performer there, the violinist, was Rachel Barton Pine, who is right here in our studio for the, gosh, it's the fourth time in 10 years. I checked the records.
Wow, I was wondering about that because I felt like I'd been here more than twice. And I guess,
That's why. That's right, yes, going back to 2003. And is this the first time that you have performed with the University of Wisconsin Symphony?
Yes, exactly. So I'm really excited to be collaborating with all of these talented college students. Of course, it's always a pleasure to return to Madison. I was thinking about it. I've played here a number of times with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra, Maestro Andrew Sewell, of course, and I'll be returning with those guys in the beginning of October of next year. And I was also in Madison at one point for the Madison Early Music Festival, playing the Rebec, the medieval ancestor of the violin from the 1200s.
Pretty much have it all covered then, don't you? From the Rebec to the electric violin.
Something like that. But of course, you know, the main heart of my existence is these great romantic concertos, and we'll be doing the Brahms this weekend, which is one of my all-time favorites.
Well, it was the Brahms' one and only violin concerto. For whatever reason, there are several major 19th and into the 20th century composers who wrote just one big landmark violin concerto, and Brahms was one of them.
Yeah, well, if you get it right, why mess with success, right?
That's true. It is a gorgeous concerto. I mean, it's just got so many songful moments.
Yeah, and actually, I have the perfect violin to play it on because my instrument, well, I say mine, but of course, I'm borrowing it from my generous patron. But this violin that I've been playing since 2002 was made in the year 1742 by Guarneri del Gesu, who's, along with Stradivari, one of the two greatest violin makers ever. In the 19th century, this instrument was the concert violin of Marie Soldat, one of the rare women violin soloists from that era. And Marie Soldat was a protege of Brahms. They frequently played chamber music together with Brahms at the piano. And when Marie Soldat needed a great instrument for her concerts, when she got to that point in her career, Brahms found an aristocratic family who agreed to purchase an instrument for her use, and Brahms himself picked this very violin. So it's amazing to think that, to get to play the music of Brahms on an instrument whose voice he himself selected, but also to realize that because Marie Soldat played chamber music with Brahms, it means my violin got to jam with Brahms.
It's a little scary from a non-violinist standpoint to see that you just have that kind of casually held on your lap like that with one hand. but violinists seem to have these Velcro fingertips when it comes to their instruments in terms of just appearing to be casual in the way they handle them.
Well, it just becomes a part of you, really.
I suppose that would be the key to it. And before time gets away from us, the program tomorrow night, 8 o'clock, at the Mills Hall on the campus of University of Wisconsin in Madison. That's November 2nd. And the program will include The Gate of Life, which is by a contemporary English composer, Philip Sawyers. You may have heard the conductor telling us that yesterday. And also, of course, the Brahms Violin Concerto with Rachel Barton Pine. And then also another work that is not exactly a pushover, which is the Shostakovich Symphony No. 5. Big program.
Yeah, indeed. Lots of work for those kids.
Well, you've got your instrument, and we'd like to hear some of it. So yeah. What do you have
Maybe start with a little Brahms. You're talking about, the breakability of these violins, and, well, at least the violins don't squirm. It's when you're holding a baby that you got to worry about things.
And you need a violin to calm that baby down.
Exactly. So this is one of Brahms' most beloved melodies, his famous lullaby. My mom sang it to me, and her mom sang it to her, and I frequently sing it to my daughter when my violin isn't in my hands. But this particular arrangement comes from the early 20th century and the great American violin soloist Albert Spaulding.
Thank you.
Well, I hope you're not the only mother who still sings or plays that lullaby for her child. It is a real classic. And on the other extreme, I do have to ask you about the heavy metal experience and all of that. It almost seems it would be impossible for one person to have such a broad repertory.
Well, I guess it's just like, you know, people who love to eat food from a bunch of different cuisines from time to time. You know, the standard violin repertoire is where I make my home, but then, you know, I love to do other things on the side. I don't really have any hobbies outside of music, and so, you know, learning about different styles of music is sort of like, you know, where all my energy goes. And heavy metal is really exciting because it's just so powerful and intense, but it all actually derives from classical, and every time I play Paganini Caprices, it's like those are just full of shredder licks. And
Paganini just didn't know that he had shredder licks in those caprices.
Actually, I think he did.
Whatever the Italian for that would be.
Exactly. Yeah. So I should probably play one of those in honor of Halloween.
Oh, sure.
This is number 13, which is just a perfect one to sort of show both sides of Paganini, his charming side and his fiery side. It's actually popularly known as the Devil's Laughter, and it's not because of the diabolical middle section. It's actually because of the sinister chuckle that happens in the beginning and the end. And, you know, people, it's so funny, they were so superstitious back then when they saw Paganini doing all these wild pyrotechnical tricks. They said he must have sold his soul to be able to play that well. And, of course, I always say, well, I just practiced a lot.
Well, he did have a couple of tricks up his sleeve, too, that were very real, let's say, and very natural, if not supernatural.
Well, yeah, and supernatural is, you know, where things were at back then. There were actually eyewitness accounts published in the newspaper of audience members who had seen a witch standing behind Paganini as he played, bowing his bow and fingering his fingers.
Well, apparently he didn't do anything to dispel that notion. He never actually said, yes, I sold my soul to the devil, but he just kind of let that ride. He was a showman. He knew how to promote
exactly.
A concert.
Well, exactly. You know, just like the Ozzy Osbourne of his day or something. He knew what was going to sell tickets.
And
it worked.
So this is the Caprice number 13, The Devil's Laughter.
Thank you.
So how hard is it to play?
Well, actually, I've been touring for the past couple of seasons doing all 24 caprices in a single evening.
Oh, wow.
Which is pretty insane, but it's an amazing journey for both the performer and the audience to just see the range of what the violin is capable of, technically and expressively. So it's really, really fun to just do them all and just explore that. So compared to that, doing just one of them is not as bad.
Do you have a sense of when you play those caprices by Paganini as to what his influences were, what his sources of inspiration were?
Absolutely. In fact, really, when one looks at Paganini's style of writing, it's so much closer to vocal music than instrumental music. He lived at the time and place of the great Italian bel canto opera composers like Donizetti, Verdi, Rossini, Bellini, and his melodies are absolutely in that vocal style. In fact, Rossini said if Paganini were ever to write opera, he would put the rest of us out of business. And that's how highly those guys regarded him as a composer of melody. So he wasn't just about fast flying fingers. It was the emotions that his playing evoked in his listeners that made all those women swoon.
Is there a composer you've discovered just recently that you're really excited about as a violinist?
Well, a living composer that I've really been enjoying collaborating with lately is Mohamed Feyrou. One of today's really exciting young composers who's been having a lot of success. His monumental five-movement unaccompanied sonata called Native Informant was just released on a Naxos album of the same title, a collection of his various chamber works, and he just finished a violin concerto for me, which is actually the first violin concerto that's ever been written for me, so I'm really excited about that. It's going to be premiered this spring.
Where are you going to play that?
We're going to do it in Kansas and Alabama to start with. And then, you know, who knows from there. But his music combines some of the violin styles of the Arabic world with Western music, which is a really powerful combination.
You know, when you listen, at least when I listen to early music, if we're going back to, 14th century and earlier, it almost seems as if Western music, European music, and Middle Eastern music were much closer together back then. I mean, in other words, if you listen to some early music, it sounds like Middle Eastern music does today.
Exactly.
So it's sort of in a sense.
In fact, that instrument we were talking about, the rebec, is actually an evolution of the Middle Eastern rebab, which was a half-gourd-shaped instrument struck with a plectrum and then came over to Europe, was made out of wood, and then the bow was drawn across the strings, and it sort of evolved from there. But yeah, there are so many connections.
Well, let's see. You have, speaking of international sounds, you've played some Piazzolla, too.
Yeah, this is from, I guess, three albums ago, my Capriccio Latino disc. And Piazzolla always included a violinist in his own bands.
Did he?
But oddly enough, he never wrote anything for solo violin. He wrote a wonderful piece called The Grand Tango for cello with piano accompaniment, which is a wonderful recital piece. And he wrote six solo etudes for flute on commission from a flutist, sort of a random thing. And all these years, violinists have had to resort to playing the flute etudes if they wanted to play something of Piazzolla and didn't have a bandoneon and a bass and everybody else at hand. But, you know, the problem with the flute etudes, of course, is that the range is limited. The figurations are much more wind-like than string-like.
Sure.
There are no double stops, none of those wonderful, ponticello and other kinds of sound effects that Piazzolla used in his string writing. And so I decided to take my favorite of them, Tango Etude No. 3, and really rework it, kind of thinking, what might Piazzolla have done if he had written this for the violin? And then as I was halfway through that process, I realized that his most famous and popular tango, the Liber Tango, is actually the same tempo and the same key as Tango Etude No. 3. And so it became a medley. And with the Liber Tango, I kind of scrunched the whole tango band into one little violin.
All right. We will, by the way, be getting to that quiz question, too, but I think it's worth the wait here. So this is, what are you calling this?
Well, it's officially called Tango Etude No. 3 con Liber Tango, but I just usually call it my Piazzolla Tango Medley.
Rachel Barton Pine. Thank you. Piazzolla on a 275-year-old violin?
Something like that. Just one violin.
they hold up well.
Made
don't
to
they?
Sound like many.
Yeah, I would say. Well, in the right hands, it does. So are there any limitations for that instrument in terms of the what we'll call loosely these days the classical repertory?
Oh, goodness, no. I mean, even though it's been my constant companion for 11 years, I'm still discovering new shades of tone colors, and its possibilities are limitless. It's a constant source of inspiration.
Well, put up with me while I do our 12:30 quiz question here, and then we're going to have one more performance from Rachel Barton Pine before she has to take off and commune with some of those young performers across the street there. This was yesterday's question. What distinction do they share? Eternal youth, a baseball victory, musical prowess, such as that possessed by Paganini and others. Let's see, unlimited knowledge and also boots full of gold. Well, all of those were things that were supposedly swapped for one's soul.
Ah.
So that was, of course, a Halloween question. Here's today's. It's actually a musical question, sort of, kind of. According to legend, when these future American revolutionaries met, one played the fiddle while the other danced a jig. One of them was not a great speaker. The other was very famous for one particular speech, and it's said that between them they were the two worst fiddlers in the colonies. They did both play the violin, apparently. So name either one of them. Make what you can of that in the next 20 minutes or so, and you just might win a prize today. And that's the treasure trove, but on top of it will be one of Rachel Barton Pine's CDs. So you can call 1-800-442-7106. It might take you a little while to get in, and you'll be talking to Nola eventually. Or you can email midday@wpr.org with your answer. We'll see what we get out of that, those two terrible fiddlers. And now back to one of the world's great ones, Rachel Barton Pine. And you have something by one of the great composers. And let's see, I can't even remember how many instruments Bach could play.
Oh, yeah.
Do we even know?
Gosh, well, he played, you know, the violoncello di spalla, the viola da gamba, harpsichord, organ. We tend to think of him for all those keyboard instruments. But in fact, the violin was the first instrument he learned, and his first professional job was as a concertmaster. And the longest fugue he ever wrote was not for organ or harpsichord. It was for the violin, his C major fugue. So the violin had a very important place in his life.
And what do you have? What do you have here?
So I thought I'd play his very first movement of his first sonata for unaccompanied violin, the G major adagio. And I am switching bows. For those of you that can't see through the airwaves, there's a different stick in my hands. It's a replica of a Baroque-style bow made out of snake wood instead of the modern Pernambuco. And so it actually creates a different palette of tone colors on the same violin and has a set of articulations and a roundness to the rolling of the chords that works really well for this music.
Well, that 275-year-old violin seemed very happy playing Bach, especially in the hands of Rachel Barton Pine. You have your latest CD we heard actually during the 11 o'clock hour. That's the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto, right?
That's right. Mendelssohn and Schumann concertos paired with both Beethoven romances. So that just came out a few weeks ago.
You're working on another one?
Yes, indeed. I actually just recorded all five Mozart violin concertos with none other than Sir Neville Mariner and the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields.
No kidding, Sir Neville.
Yeah, 89 years old and going strong.
Yeah, he has to be the most recorded conductor in the world these days.
Well, as a Mozart interpreter, he's second to none. So it was just an amazing experience. And that disc will be out in the spring. And
one disc? Must be two.
Double album, yes. And I actually used all of my own cadenzas, so that was really fun to sort of put my own personality in there with Mozart's. And
that's great. Yeah, great opportunity. And we'll be looking forward to seeing those Mozart violin concertos. And in the meantime, much closer at hand is the concerto, is the concerto, the Brahms concerto, violin concerto tomorrow night with the UW Symphony Orchestra. Kenneth Woods will be conducting. He was with me yesterday sharing some of his recordings and insights into this music, and always a pleasure to have you here, Rachel.
Wonderful to be here. And I'll look forward to that fifth appearance in not too distant future.
Don't stay away so long. All right. In a moment, I'll repeat today's 12:30 quiz question here on WPR.